Hi, this is Heather Esposito, and this is Leadership by Design. Welcome to today's episode of Leadership by Design. Today's guest is Dr. Dan Radecki, who's the co-founder at the Academy of Brain-Based Leadership, which offers a scientifically validated brain-based approach for future-oriented leaders and organizations interested in optimizing their performance, relationships, and health. The Academy of Brain-Based Leadership is a strategic partner of Herman Miller Group. Dan also serves as Executive Director of Research and Development at AbbVie, Inc., where he is a global leader for their drug development programs. Dan holds a bachelor's in psychology, master's in biopsychology, and a PhD in neuroscience. Working as a leader in the corporate world allows Dan the unique perspective on how our knowledge of brain functioning can aid leaders in maximizing their results as well as the results of their teams. With this unique perspective from roles in both the leadership and neuroscientific world, in 2009, Dan created the content for the educational arm of the NeuroLeadership Institute and served as the lead professor and advisor for the Master of Science program in the Neuroscience of Leadership. This was the first university-accredited program ever developed to incorporate cutting-edge neuroscience research into an optimal model of leadership. In the following 10 years, Dan has taught thousands of leaders in 40 countries on the neuroscientific underpinnings of effective leadership. Over the years, Dan has realized the wide-ranging applications for a brain-based leadership approach and has a passion for bringing this information to children and teens. He has seen the positive impact that this self-awareness can have on youth in areas such as bullying, academic achievement, social relationships, and emotional regulation. And he envisions a day when this curriculum becomes mainstream in our schools. Amen to that. Dan co-authored the book Psychological Safety, Managing the Hidden Drivers of Individual Behavior and Team Success. He has been guest editor on a special issue for the Journal of Consulting Psychology, written numerous peer-reviewed scientific articles, been published in the Harvard Business Review, delivered a TEDx keynote, and has lectured internationally on topics such as the neuroscience of resilience, bias, creativity, leadership wisdom, the aging brain, the biology of collaboration, and the impact of stress on the brain. Welcome, Dan. We're so excited to have you today.
Thanks, Heather. I love this conversational forum. It's fun to talk about this.
It is. And it's exciting to have a real neuroscientist on here. I always say like I'm a wannabe neuroscientist, but now I get to talk to the real neuroscientist.
You don't hear that much where someone says, I'm excited to have a neuroscientist to talk to.
Well, we're here today to talk about our practice of build trust and belonging. That was one of the reasons why I invited you here, because in that practice, we really have embedded the concept of psychological safety. And I know that's what your book's about, and that's what your organization serves to do, to help inform people and organizations on how to build a higher level of psychological safety. So can we just start off by talking a little bit about what psychological safety is and level setting on a common definition for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this idea of psychological safety, it's been around for a long time, but there's a lot of interest in it recently because of some research that's been done and showing sort of tangible benefits of it. Just, I think for argument's sake, think of psychological safety as a belief. Think of it in a team context. It's a shared belief that the team is safe, that it's safe for interpersonal risk-taking. Okay. Now, that can be sort of variable because you have to ask yourself, what does interpersonal risk-taking mean? And Amy Edmondson, who is one of the gurus of this field, just sort of narrowed it down to, it's a sense of confidence that when you're in a team environment, that others aren't going to embarrass or reject or punish you because you speak up. So it really is, people think of psychological safety as trust, and it's actually more than that. It really is about this ability to have confidence that you can be open, you can share your thoughts and feelings, and there's not going to be retribution.
And so what results when teams are able to do that, what's the resulting impact? Why does this matter?
Yeah, so the research that has been done in this field has shown a nice correlation between teams that have high psychological safety and performance, teams that are high performing. And from a, as a neuroscience sort of geek perspective, it makes sense, because what's happening here, when you have psychological safety, when you feel at ease to be yourself, and that's really what a lot of this is about. You come into a team, you come into work, and you can be your true self. When we have to pretend we're something we're not. Okay, so if you disagree with a conversation that's going on and you don't speak up because you're worried people might question your intelligence or laugh at you, that takes a lot of mental energy to sort of suppress that, to not be your true self and maybe to agree with people even though you don't. So when you suppress that and when there's not psychological safety, it actually drains resources from the part of your brain that you use to be creative, to think clearly, that higher brain called the prefrontal cortex that we use. And so it really then what happens when you don't have psychological safety in a team is you don't get your best performance out of people. So when Google showed a few years ago this correlation between psychological safety on a team and performance, I think a lot of organizations, a lot of people noticed it and said, wow, this is something we really maybe should invest in, and we should think about how we build psychological safety in a team, because it seems to be important for performance, not only on the team, but then outside the team environment, because you bring your brain everywhere you go.
We hope so anyway. So if I heard you correctly, if I am using the brain capacity I have to hold myself back or to be more concerned with what other people are thinking or what they may think about me rather than what I have to contribute, I'm actually hindering myself from the brain capacity I have to do creative work or...
Yeah, exactly. The whole field of neuroscience now is moving towards being proactive and with our brain, what our brain can do. And by that, I mean building sort of resilience and keeping that higher brain that, like I said, it's called the prefrontal cortex, that part of the brain that allows us to do these uniquely human things like empathize and be creative and plan for the future, keeping that part of the brain strong because we know stress impacts it and decreases its ability to work. And so do things that cause us to have to, like I said, hide our true feelings and pretend we're something we're not. It's simply about freeing that area of the brain up to do what it does best.
That makes a lot of sense. So can I maybe have you either confirm or debunk some myths I sometimes hear about psychological safety and see whether you think this is part of it or it isn't?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so one of the things that I have heard is, oh, so like we have to make sure everybody feels comfortable so that they'll be psychologically safe.
Yeah, that's a myth. That's a myth because that's not sustainable. You can't do that all the time. And actually probably would be detrimental if you set this false environment that everyone is at peace and nirvana and there's no conflict and everyone agrees with each other. To me, it's more about being comfortable about being uncomfortable. So in other words, you can get to a state where, okay, I know we're going to get into this team meeting and we're going to have some really, contentious discussions where we need to come to a conclusion, but I'm okay with that because I know that I'm going to be true and genuine and people are going to accept that. They're not going to laugh at me. They're not going to reject me. So I think it's more about being comfortable with being uncomfortable. Most people can't do that.
Why is that? Why can't we be comfortable being uncomfortable?
Because being uncomfortable is a threat to our brains. And when I say uncomfortable in terms of conflict and directly opposing someone's opinion and having a discussion about that to get to an end outcome. Our brains don't like, just at a very basic level of the wiring, our brains don't like when someone disagrees with us, because in our brain takes that as meaning that either we're wrong or they're wrong. There's no in between. And so all these mechanisms kick in that, as I said earlier, start to inhibit our higher brain from working properly and functioning all the way. So that uncomfort, that discomfort then that we experience can really lead to a rabbit hole where we start to take offense and we start to become emotional. And when we start to become emotional, that's when that higher brain really starts to become impacted.
Yeah, we typically don't I won't use the word respond, but we typically don't react really well when we're being driven by stronger emotion.
Oh, sure. Sure. And particularly with most of the work we do in our world today, which is cognitively driven stuff that you have to think. You know, if you're doing landscaping 10 hours a day, that's a little different. But if we're in a room and we're trying to develop a strategy, you need that higher brain for that. You need to be fully on board.
Absolutely. All right. So here's another one. I think you kind of played to it a little bit, but it's like, there's this impression that psychological safety is about being nice, or we have to stay away from hard conversations.
Yeah, that's
laughing
sort of,
again.
it sort of goes along the same line. I think being nice and staying away from hard conversations, it almost does more harm than good, because it, you know, we definitely want to build, I used the word resilience before. With psychological safety, as you established it on the team, it almost, it's like it builds up resilience or mental toughness in that part of the brain, in the emotional brain that would normally, when you have a hard conversation, the emotional brain would jump in and take offense and start using emotional language and playing the blame game and that type of thing. If you can get to a point where you can have those hard conversations, you don't have to always be perfectly pleasant and walking around like you're wearing rose-colored glasses. It helps you in that team environment because people understand then that you're being true to yourself. But it also helps you when you leave that team environment, because again, when you're building these capacities up in the brain to have hard conversations, it can extend to when you go home and you're having a conversation with your spouse or your kids.
Yeah, we've seen that a lot. Well, you know that your safety model is part of our coaching program. That's actually mm-hmm. how we got introduced to it. And we have participants come back and report that they think about psychological safety as much in their personal interactions at home with their kids in their communities as they do at work. So it's definitely a skill that ends up transcending.
And I think one of the things I've seen, Heather, the important part for all that with the hard conversations is that when you have these hard conversations, it's usually because you want some change. You want a behavioral change, or you want some outcome from it that's different than what's going on now. And to do that, usually it's a two-way street. There's some concessions that need to be made to be able to do that. And you have to be able to appreciate the other person's perspective. You have to understand where they're coming from. And to do that, that idea of putting yourself in someone else's shoes is a very high level, almost uniquely human trait. And to do it, you need that higher brain fully on board. So if you go into an emotional tirade when you're trying to have hard conversations, you're never going to be able to appreciate what the other person is saying or where they're coming from to get to change. So that's what I've seen where it becomes very beneficial. If you want change, if you want behavioral modification, you need to be able to get out of that emotional conversation mode.
You know, not to make this conversation political, but I think there's never been a time where we've seen more of what you just described than for here in America with our recent political elections. I don't care which side you were on. It was so emotionally charged, so polarizing that nobody, from what I'm hearing, just people didn't have the physical capacity to even be able to hear, take in the alternative point of view or even a more complex point of view, because we were already so married to this position that was driven by an emotional response. Is that accurate?
Oh, definitely. And just remember one key point about how our brain works. It wants to follow the path of least resistance. So your brain's like any other part of your body or even in biology, which is it wants to use as little energy as possible to get something done. So the way your brain works, because it wants to do that too, if you're faced with an opposing viewpoint or something that is different than your sort of core belief, your brain's first reaction is going to be to say, that's wrong. This person is different than me. And you start even using different parts of your brain to deal with them. We call it the in-group, out-group. And they become someone that's sort of foreign to you. And you dismiss them. And this is, like you say, this is what has happened in our political system in the US. And so it becomes very difficult then to even deal with that person on any level once you're at that point. Yeah,
that's true. As you were talking about the being nice and staying away from hard conversations, it also made me think of Brené Brown's work, where she talks about clear is kind, unclear is unkind. And that if we're not being clear with people and we're not giving them the feedback that we owe to them as leaders, that's not kind. It's like holding back and being nice is actually doing them a disservice. We owe it to them, if we want to help them grow and develop, to be able to give that to them. And that's not unkind.
Of course. And it doesn't do them any good in the long run, because eventually you're going to encounter more people than not who aren't kind, who aren't trying to appease them.
So one more myth I've heard: unconditional praise. Is that part of psychological safety?
Oh, not at all. All of this is about genuineness, psychological safety, and unconditional praise or false praise. Our brain is really good at picking up if someone is being genuine or not. And we don't even realize it. It's done below our level of our cognitive control and that higher brain. So we don't realize it. But if someone is in front of you not being genuine, we'll pick up on subtle cues, very, very, very subtle cues. And your brain will let you know that this person isn't being genuine. And even though you can't put a finger on what it is, you just have this gut feeling of, I don't trust this person. I don't know what they're doing. And so again, with the unconditional praise, because it's not genuine, you'll pick it up. Your emotions will somehow play into this, and you'll have that gut feeling that you can't trust this person. And it's not sustainable. This unconditional praise, if that's where we think is important in a team and psychological safety, once you get out of the realm of the team and then you don't have that unconditional praise, now you're going to even have more of an emotional response, because you're saying, well, why aren't you praising me? That's all I get all the time on my teams. What's wrong with you?
And if I heard you right just a second ago, if I'm getting that, it actually can take away from trust and belonging, because I know it's feigned or insincere.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, if the site safety in the team is all about being able to be vulnerable and having that sense of interpersonal trust between members, and you're realizing that the leader is giving you false praise, unconditional praise, there's going to be a piece of you that, again, even if you don't realize it, is not trusting, because you realize that's at the core of your emotions and your brain, that this isn't real. This person's not being genuine with me.
Yeah, so that may be a nice segue into one of our key practices that falls under cultivate connection for us, and how important it is for us to cultivate connections, not only within our team, but between teams, across functions of the business, to build trust and belonging. So if a leader is listening to this podcast and one of the areas that they're digging into is wanting to build trust and belonging, utilizing this lens of psych safety, what would you say to that leader that's looking to build this practice?
Yeah, to build trust and belonging. I think it's important to make this distinction between trust and psychological safety. I think a lot of times what I've seen over the years is people equate the two to each other. And it's a little bit different than that. Psych safety, granted, psychological safety is easier to develop when there's trust among team members, but it's a different concept. Psychological safety is sort of a function of the group, where trust is really between a couple individuals, two individuals.
Nice distinction.
And think about it as psychological safety. Think about it as an immediate experience, while trust is about the future moment. So I think you're going to respond respectively to me in this moment, even if you don't like what I say. All right. Versus I trust you to act in a certain way, a specific way in the future. So I think psych safety, it does go beyond interpersonal trust. It really speaks also to respect for each other's competence, trust in your intentions, caring about other people. So I think there is a distinction there. Now, in terms of building trust and belonging in psychological safety, yeah, they do, I believe, go together. In fact, I think that to really establish a sense of belonging, you use the word belonging, you need psychological safety. It's almost like to get to that level, that high level of belonging, psychological safety in a team, that is almost a prerequisite. I think about it this way. We have a lot of, in the corporate world, at least from what I've seen, it used to be diversity and inclusion were the buzzwords. And now it's more, inclusion has gone beyond that to belonging. Mm. Inclusion is a behavior, but belonging is sort of an emotional outcome that people want from that. And belonging is that higher level. It's almost like Maslow's hierarchy of need with self-actualization. It's what's fueling a desire to have purpose, a sense of purpose at work or a sense of community. So I see belonging is about more about creating that emotional connection and a sense of community, whereas inclusion may be more about having your voice heard. So it's levels up to that.
Does that make sense? Yeah, no, I really like how you made that distinction about inclusion being the behavior and belonging being the emotional response to that. I never really thought about it in that way before, but that makes a lot of sense.
And it's more difficult too, obviously. The belonging, it's really a buzzword now, and people, a lot of organizations are even putting it into their mission statements. And I think even if you, I love it because it, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when we started doing all this, if you would have used the word belonging for a mission statement for a Fortune 500 company, they would have laughed. Again, you know, to the beginning that where we talked about, well, that's a sort of a squishy, soft idea. What does that have to do with anything in a corporate mission statement? But there's really starting to be an awareness of how important belonging is. And when you do tap into that belonging, you're tapping into that part of the brain that deals with social connectedness and emotions. And this is a huge part of our brain. We're social animals as humans. And so really, I think that there's going to be a big benefit in the future for people and organizations thinking about belonging in that way.
Well, yeah, really. I'm sitting here pondering quite a few things because I've never even heard you say that before in those ways. So it's unlocking new thinking for me. Can we maybe kind of switch over a little bit into some of your work specifically around the safety model? It's part of our coaching program. So those leaders who have been exposed to our coaching program are familiar. We actually leveraged some of your material early in the pandemic when we were just trying to help people understand what was, to your point, some of the brain function of what was happening in that moment. And as leaders, how could they help their teams kind of lead through this time of disruption? How could we help their employees be able to stay focused during this time of disruption? So we've kind of briefly introduced bits and pieces of it into the organization. And yeah, I was in your first certification class for for your model. And I would say one of the things that I've really learned is I thought psychological safety was a leadership skill, that as a leader could create psychological safety in the team by the way they talked about making mistakes or the way they facilitated discussions. And as I've done more of this work and been a member of a team that had a pretty high level of psychological safety, I've kind of changed my mind about that a leader plays a role and definitely creates, and now that I've heard you talk, I would describe it as trust, you know, that interpersonal one-on-one relationship. There's high trust, mm-hmm. high psychological safety with the members of the team, but it's really about the team and the individuals on the team committing to create that for each other. If a team really has psychological safety, I mean, yes, a leader can set a framework, but it's really a team sport.
Oh, it definitely is. And even when Google did some of the research, the seminal research showing tangible benefits to team performance with psychological safety, it really was about the teams, the individual contributors having psychological safety, and it builds upon that mm-hmm. team. It really wasn't just about the leader. And I think that's really important because in the work that we've done with teams and going through this and seeing the results, the team dynamic is really the culture. The leader can set the stage, right? I mean, you can have, we've done this workshop where you have 20 team members and the leaders on the workshop with them learning about this. And you see it play out that the culture is really driven by that that interaction between the various team members, not necessarily what the leader does, because if the leader is driving a certain behavior or a way that, they feel the team should operate, the team can take that with a grain of salt. But it really is about how they're interacting between each other in the trenches every day, whereas the leader may not be there. So I think that those team members, it's really important for them to establish it with each other. And when we do the workshops, we actually do that. We have team members working with each other. Everyone sees what their drivers of psychological safety are so that they come to sort of a better appreciation of each other.
Every member of our North American sales team has been through a team safety workshop, and it really is a powerful experience to watch the dynamic and the conversations that unfold between the team members and the commitments they make to each other that I don't think are conversations that we normally lean into or frankly even have if it wasn't for the structure.
Oh no, I love when we do some of these workshops where people say, you know, we never sit down at work to have time to actually ask the question, what do you need? You know, what is your brain, to be a geek, what does your brain need to function at its best? What are your needs so you feel psychologically safe? We don't ask those questions at work. And so when people do this, they just stop and reflect. They say, wow, this is really important. I never knew that you had a high need to control, for autonomy, to control what the team's doing. That explains why we don't get along so, you know, these types of things.
It is such a nice marriage for us specifically at Herman Miller Group, because we have a whole position and approach to how we see space and how people use their space for work called Living Office. And early in that work, we talked about the fundamental human needs that go into office design. And it was based upon the same body of work that your research, or yeah, same body of research that your work's based upon, informed those. And actually, for the most part, they map very nicely one-to-one. So for us particularly, it was like, this is such a perfect extension of how we already think about the work we do in designing space. But can you talk a little bit about the value of giving language to these things that we kind of innately know, but don't know how to communicate? When you say, like, here's what my brain needs.
Yeah.
How does language make a difference or support that in a new way?
Yeah, language is key to a lot of this. In fact, when we talk about building psychological safety and our safety model we use, a lot of it is also around establishing a culture where the language is understood and people are able to convey their thoughts in a language that's not threatening. So, you know, coaches understand this, the importance of language and having meaningful conversations. And going back to that whole, just think of your brain as a constant struggle between that emotional brain that really wants to either lash out at someone if you're angry or express themselves in violent ways, versus that controlled brain, that uniquely human higher brain. And the language is what really helps us keep that emotional brain at bay in other people. So, for example, when you understand about these drivers, let's say that for psychological safety, I know that someone has a driver for fairness, let's say. And if I see them standing up in a meeting and wanting to take control, have their say or get their message out there, and I understand that this is their sense of fairness creeping up, I can sort of diffuse my need or my desire to shut them down or yell at them. And I could just simply use the language of, you know, I understand your need for fairness right now. And I'm willing to be able to meet that need. So the language, I see it as really important for diffusing the emotional brain in people, because we're so used to just the way our brains are wired, reacting through language. This is how we communicate. There's a lot of research around the brain and language and how important words, specific words, can be for bringing out the best or worst in people. So I think our goal is to be able to get people to have self-awareness about what's driving them, what's driving their psychological safety, what's driving their triggers, and then establishing language around that so you're not triggering other people. The end result being that we're sort of conversing on a neutral plane where we're not bringing in all these emotions so that we really can get the most out of our conversations.
Yeah, I play a little game with myself about when I find myself getting triggered by something, seeing which, in your model, it's which of the safety needs are being triggered right now. And like, what is it about that? And see if I can get underneath it, because it feels much easier for me to deal with it if it's, hey, I'm not feeling like I have the level of autonomy I'd like to have, versus somebody just took something away from me. And now it's like, it's more about that person and it's personal and it's blame. And
it's a lot easier.
A lot of story that goes along with that about why that happened. And typically that doesn't serve me, but if I can figure out it's about autonomy, it's much easier for me to go back and have a conversation to understand either, can I have more choice or can I have some greater autonomy in how I get there? Or at least understand what's going on. But
that's the struggle, right? It's like you just said, it's easier. If someone's annoying me because they're not getting with the program, it's easier. And again, what our brain wants, path of least resistance, to just have those emotions fly out of your mouth because you don't have to filter them with that higher brain, than it is to just take a step back and pause and say, okay, what's driving this behavior? How am I feeling? Why am I? That's a lot of work. So a part of this whole process is really, and I'm going to use it literally from a neuroscience standpoint, rewiring your brain so that you're not so reactive, but rather you have self-awareness and you can take a second. And that's all it takes to diffuse that whole emotional outburst, a split second to pause and say, okay, what's really going on here? I don't want to be a slave to my emotions. Let me just figure this out. It's not easy to do.
No, it's not. I will say it does get easier, but I also notice some of them typically compound for me. You know, so I tend to be high in autonomy. My fuse is pretty short for autonomy and it's pretty short for esteem. And so here's the fun story I tell myself. If you're not giving me the level of autonomy I really like on an initiative or a project, you must not think I'm capable. That's why you took it away. So like I get in this fun little game and story of both of those. So that's the A and the E in the safety model of just, I'm good. I'm really good at the story.
That's a pretty complex storytelling, Heather. Wow. That's.
Is that common?
Very common. Very common. These play off of each other all the time. And a lot of times, like you say, someone will have a primary driver. I know autonomy is mine as well. And I get caught up in that. If I even have a hint of someone trying to take over, it's easy to go down that rabbit hole of, wait a minute, you're micromanaging me. You don't trust me. That's not fair. What's wrong with me? And right there, I just hit the trust and the fairness and the esteem and the autonomy. So this is how our brains work.
And so, for our leaders who are listening that maybe haven't been through the coaching workshop and haven't had deeper exposure into your model and some of the psychological safety work, what advice can you give them today of things that they can do to start to create greater psychological safety in their teams?
I would think, and we struggled with this question for years as we thought about what's the most effective way. And I think what I've seen and experienced personally as a leader is really, if there's one take-home message, it would be to increase your self-awareness. Start with yourself. Increasing your self-awareness of what drives your triggers. I'm gonna say your psychological safety triggers, but it's really stress triggers. We have physical stress and we have psychological stress. What's driving your psychological stress triggers? Because once those triggers are flipped, you're going to go into that emotional brain. And if you can have a little self-awareness about what's doing that, you and I just talked about autonomy, then it'll give you a better chance of taking that split second pause between thinking and reacting. And that, if you can do that, if you can have a little self-awareness about what triggers you from a psychological safety standpoint, and then make that next leap of self-awareness and being able to pause before you react, you're probably ahead of 99.99% of the people on this earth, because most people don't have that self-awareness. And you could argue that's why in many instances in society where we at today, because we don't have that ability.
So how do you get greater self-awareness? I mean, you know, it's like when we don't know what we don't know what's the first step in?
I mean, well, that's why we came up with the safety model, as you mentioned earlier. It really is a sort of high-level way of thinking about what are the most common triggers for people's psychological safety, psychological stress, and where do those rank? So we came up with the assessment just to get a way of quantifying which one of these five, security, autonomy, fairness, esteem, and trust, which one of those are most important to me? And then knowing that, okay, what can I do about it? How can I just make a little bit of a dent of becoming self-aware of my high need for autonomy? Okay, I have a high need. Now, let me think about how that comes off to other people. Am I coming off to my team as overly prescriptive when I tell them what to do and managing too closely because I feel like I have to be in control? Maybe I can step back. I have an understanding that that's impacting other people. Then once you get that self-awareness, it tends to open it up to now an appreciation of awareness of other people. Now, I know I have a high sense of autonomy. I can see a high sense of autonomy in others and how it impacts people around them. Or conversely, and here's the hard part, I have a high sense of need for autonomy or control, and I have people on my team who don't. They have, in fact, they have a low need for autonomy, which I could never understand. Why would you want to be a sheep? Why would you want to follow? But once you understand that this is their brain's needs, it's not personal, it becomes much easier to appreciate that. And then it magically opens up these abilities to understand what a low need autonomy person brings to the table in a team and why they may be that way. So I think that self-awareness is really a key piece to this.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, this is a little bit different than, say, if I'm familiar with the DISC behavioral styles, because when you typically learn DISC, it's about we want to educate others so that you know better how to deal with me. Because, hey, I'm a high D or I'm a high I. And so here's what you can do differently so that I can be me. And, you know, some people learn the other side of it, which is what might I need to temper, knowing how that could land on other people. But when I hear you talk about the safety needs, it's more about, not that people should just accommodate us is the best way I know to describe it, but to become aware of where things are landing for me. And in some cases, maybe I can ask for more of what I need when I feel like it's not being met, and use that as a conversation, kind of discussion, negotiation point, if you will, versus you have to tend to me because this is my need.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. Because when you say something to the effect of, here's who I am, here's how you deal with me, people, which is really what it's about, people, a lot of times they'll resent that. Why am I deferring to you? Why do I have to? And when you take sort of a self-centered approach of, here's who I am, here's how I come off, here's how people in reality deal with me, how can I make it better? How can I make it a more positive interaction? I think that's more effective, because the self-awareness piece can then, as I said earlier, it opens it up to understanding not only yourself, but now an appreciation of what others are going through. And that seems to be, and when I think, bring it back to psychological safety, that seems to be an important part for that trust and empathy between individuals, and having an environment where it's wide open. If I'm on a team and you're telling me, well, Dan, this is who I am, this is what color I am, and this is how you need to treat me, that may not open up the best dynamic for a true psychologically safe team. But if you have everyone on the team with a little bit of understanding of who they are and what their triggers are, and then an appreciation of others, what they're going through, then I think that really lends itself more to psychological safety.
the last team I worked on, we made it fun. So we all knew the psychological safety language. We had been kind of embedded in some of that work. And so one of the ways that we described that lower brain activity or the amygdala, we would call it our red dot. And we're like, oh man, my red dot's hurting right now. And that was kind of our code language for like, something's triggering me. And, yes. You know, we were able to laugh about it. And then we were able to kind of talk about that versus the emotional response we were having. It's like, okay, so like, what is it? What's hurting your red dot? And that was a much different type of conversation and one that we could typically work through pretty quickly once it was out on the table. Because sometimes, I know we haven't talked a lot about the model, but if it was somebody with a high need for security that felt like they didn't have enough information or they didn't have enough background on what we were talking about, and they said that, we're like, okay, so what do you need? And so then we could have a conversation that got them the information they needed versus sitting there triggered and emotional because they felt like they were being left out. Or if somebody's need for fairness wasn't being triggered, like, I don't know where I fit in here. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. Like, it made a huge difference in the way we moved through, I think, things that normally stymie teams.
Well, and that's because, again, you're using, when you go to that, and this is why I love the whole idea around the language, when you use the language centers, we have, a thing as well in my teams where we have someone who's really high need for security on our team. And it's great because this person keeps us in check. They really do. Otherwise, my team is shiny object to shiny object. But there will be times where she will just stop in the middle of a meeting and say, security check. And immediately we know what that means. Whereas if you didn't have that language, she might stand up and say, you guys are just crazy. You're moving too fast. You're not appreciating the compliance regulations in this case, the SOPs, all these types of things, which would trigger people in a second. So I think that language, it really, once you go to that language area of the brain, you're not in the emotional area of the brain. They're very distinct regions. So it makes things easier. It makes it easier to have those conversations.
Words matter. Language matters. I say that all the time in coaching, not only how we say it, but the words we choose. I mean, just that example in and of itself, that those are two very different conversations. Oh, security check, where we all know we need to check in, you know, like we need to stop and pause and get some information on the table versus you're not in this and you didn't do this. And you
actually, it's interesting because I've had this team for years, and in the old days, she used to say, you guys are all attention deficit. You can't focus. You can't. And of course, you can imagine the response versus security check. It was totally, it was night and day.
Awesome. I love that example. Let me ask you, can I switch over to you personally? Because one of the things we like to talk to leaders about is like kind of their own leadership development journey. Would that be okay?
Sure.
So considering that leadership development is always an ongoing journey, never complete, what's calling you to a greater level in your own personal leadership right now?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think probably a more thorough understanding of diversity in general. Because, you know, back in the early days, I was on the same page as most people are in thinking of diversity in a very linear fashion. When you hear the word diversity, you think of what's in front of us, visually speaking, race, gender, body type. And going through what I have in the past 12 years in these types of programs and studying the brain, I'm really getting that appreciation of diversity of thought and diversity of behavior. Okay. So your diversity, and that's what the safety model is about, right? What's driving your thought process based on your psychological safety? My example of autonomy is a big driver for me. So my thought process, the way I see the world, is through that lens of, can I be controlling this? Can I be in charge? Can I be calling the shots? And appreciation that's how I see the world, but that other people who don't see the world that way, that's fine. They bring something to the table too, and that's what their brain needs. And I think that's one thing, appreciating and tolerating other people who don't have the same needs as my brain, but in trying to get beyond that, and actually rewiring my brain to accept that. So when I see someone who has no care in the world about being in control, no need for autonomy, I don't have to stop and do something called reappraisal, which is go in my mind and tell the story about why this person doesn't have a need for control or autonomy, and you know, make up a story and do that whole process of reappraisal. I actually get to a point where I don't even have to think about it. I accept them. And getting to that point of acceptance of diversity of thought and behavior, as opposed to tolerating it or reappraising it. That's what my journey is.
Yeah, I spent this weekend reading Adam Grant's new book, Think Again. Have you seen that yet?
I have. I haven't read it though.
Oh, awesome read. And it really is digging into what you just talked about, is not only kind of accepting why I'm, you know, why I feel that way, but how could I be wrong about this? Yes. What are the other perspectives? Like, what do I need to rethink here? What am I missing from my own viewpoint or my own vantage point, and really seeking to understand that with more curiosity, which he describes as a scientist's mind, and bringing that to him.
And it's sort of a journey, because to me, embracing other people's viewpoints that are very different than mine, you go on the spectrum. At first, it's at the far end of the spectrum. When you encounter someone with sort of a totally different perspective than you, it's about, okay, I'm going to emotionally react to them. Then with a little bit more self-awareness, you can maybe tolerate it. Then with a little bit more, you can probably reappraise it, where you hear it and then you take it in and you think about it and you tell yourself a story of why they're not such a bad person. The other end of the spectrum in the journey is, like I said, acceptance and rewiring non-judgment, so that you don't even have to allocate any resources to dealing with it. It is what it is. And I think there's research around that, and how when you get to that point where you rewire your brain for this type of acceptance, true acceptance of diversity in that way, it opens up your brain. It frees a lot of energy and space to do the things you need to do.
And I won't say the name of the university because I'll get it wrong, but in the book, he talks about the work that's done in a difficult conversations lab, where they do research about helping people find common ground and some of those things. And one of the things that's really stuck with me that I'm finding, thinking about a lot, is they discovered that if you introduce more complexity into the conversation, so for example, let's take gun control. You know, you mm-hmm. typically have people who's like, yes, we need to, no, we don't. And there's two positions, but the more complexity about the nuances of all the different positions and the trade-offs and what you give up actually helped people come together on other difficult conversation topics, because it primed people's brains for the fact that, like, black and white issues are not black and white.
The brain can actually, it's very adaptable. We call it plasticity. And when you do these types of activities where you build complexity in these types of situations where there's a difference of opinion, your brain actually becomes adept at taking in all this different information to come to a conclusion, so that in the future, it's actually easier to do. You're actually building a competency by doing this. And there's a whole field of stress resilience, whereby you introduce more and more stress to people in a gradual manner. And then in the future, their brain is able to handle stress better. So it really is sort of a concept with the brain that you can build competencies and rewire it to be able to be good at doing these types of things in complex environments.
So if I'm somebody who's highly reactive now, there's hope for me that I can get to a better place.
You can rewire that, definitely.
Awesome. Great news. Well, as we wind up today, Dan, I could really talk to you about this all day and would love to have you back as we continue our journey and we move into kind of a 201, 301 level concept of psych safety. But I have a couple questions I'd like to wind up with. I shared our leadership model with you, and we always ask each guest, what was your favorite leadership principle or practice that was on there and why?
Oh, favorite leadership. So I think for me, it really is about this speaks to a lot of things, but vulnerability. Mm. And I don't know if that goes under the auspice of being genuine and trust, but I think what I've found both in the leadership practice and in studying this is that if you can show mistakes and directly admit to, you know, own up and address them, it really does speak volumes to people on the team that you're leading that A, you're human, that you don't expect, that the fact that I'm addressing my mistakes immediately and talking about them and learning from them, it sets the stage for the team to be able to feel comfortable doing that with each other. And I think what I've seen over the years is that's probably one of the biggest assets in any team where you're trying to be creative and do that work, that cognitive work. And I always go back to what Einstein said about it. He says, if you're a person who's never made a mistake, then you've never tried anything new. And it really is the truth. We learn so much more from our mistakes. And I talk to teams about why that is from a neural perspective. But we learn more, much more from our mistakes than we do from our accomplishments. So I really think it's important for a leader to model that and show vulnerability in this type of realm with mistakes and letting the team. Because it really does set the stage for the team to do that with each other.
We did almost call that one out specifically. And yeah. Then we didn't because we felt like it belonged under embrace a growth mindset, choose stretch over status quo, build trust and belonging, that vulnerability crossed over so many areas that we just made it part of a number of our practices versus calling it out specifically because it was so important.
And I think it does. It really helps with building the belonging and trust because admitting mistakes, in my experience, almost has been sort of the last stage that people do before they totally embrace that vulnerability and psychological safety. It's very hard. We just have all these wired processes to avoid anyone thinking that we're mistaken and that we're not up to par with everyone else on the team. So that's a difficult one.
It's scary. It's scary to be vulnerable.
Yeah, of course.
It's a lot of courage. Yeah. If you worked at Herman Miller Group, which principle or practice would be the greatest growth opportunity for you as you look across those?
Ooh, I know what I have. I know what that greatest opportunity would be. Actually, I don't know which one it falls under though, because to me, it I mentioned it before. The greatest growth opportunity for me still is an understanding and appreciation of people who don't have a need to lead and to be in control. And you could throw it under the category of autonomy and the safety model, but still getting to the point where when I meet people in this situation, it's automatic that I accept it and I understand it. It's still a struggle for me because it's such a strong need for me. And it's, you know, you can go back to where do these triggers come from? And I know why. In my childhood, I have a strong need for autonomy, how I grew up. And that was ingrained for years and years and years. So trying to rewire it so that it's not an issue, it takes time. And there are times when there's a lot of stress going on that it starts to pop out and you have to catch it. So to me, that's the biggest growth opportunity. But trying to think what that would fall under for your model.
Maybe like unlocking your own potential. Like, where does that get in your way? Where does that hold you back?
Well, that's definitely the biggest one.
we all have them. It's always an ongoing journey. All right, four rapid fire questions before we end up.
Okay.
Fill in the blank. Leadership is?
Difficult.
True. Who's a leader you admire and why?
I like to think of the ones who I've experienced over the years. If you want someone in the mainstream that people would know.
No, just a leader you admire and why.
Oh, wow. Okay, let me think. Give me a second here. So, I mean, I've had leaders through my career who I admired. And one in particular, my first job, who was the medical director where I worked, the reason to this day that I like to emulate his role, his approach is because he showed, and maybe that why I think this is important, he showed total vulnerability. And in terms of, as I mentioned before, admitting to mistakes, but in addition to that, he was one who would make the team feel like he had your back in front of the senior management. No matter what happened, he would take the blame if it was bad. If it was an accomplishment, no matter what happened, it was the team's accomplishment. It was not his. So he really was that person. You felt like when you feel like someone stands up for you in that situation, and they're the buffer between you and the rest of the organization, it really does establish psychological safety. I felt that was really impactful for the entire team. And it stuck with me for decades.
That's amazing. And just before you even knew what psychological safety was.
Oh, yeah.
It's, we think we sometimes underestimate how impactful, like the things that we do as leaders that we take for granted. And just look, that one behavior has stuck with you throughout your whole career.
It was
such a strong impression on you as a new employee, young employee. Powerful lessons. What are you reading right now?
Oh, right now what I'm reading is probably different from this that this audience would think about, but it's a book which is highlighting the novel treatments for psychiatric illnesses. And so it's it's probably not something that's directly related to the topic of the conversation, but I think one that probably people would like would be one that's by John Brockman called This Explains Everything. And it's really elegant theories of how the world works. And it's a combination of a whole bunch of different sort of disciplines, scientific, psychiatric, all these types of things.
Interesting. Yeah, even though we may not be reading novel treatments for psychiatric illnesses, the thing that I take away from that, though, is your desire to continuously learn and not get stuck in old patterns and want to learn about what's coming, what people are thinking about towards the future, that desire for ever ongoing learning.
Well, and it keeps you engaged. I get bored really easily. And if no other reason than a lot of the research that we've done has shown that if you stop learning and using that cognitive part of the brain, you're more susceptible to dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that. So if for no other reason, it's for that.
Good. And last one, your favorite part of your work.
Oh, my favorite part of my work is definitely, and it goes along with that last response, is diving into something new, a new topic, a new area that people may not believe or even know about, to bring it out, to really bring out the complex, in most cases, the complex medical or scientific data and try to just make it digestible for most people, to try to interpret it so people understand, you know, you've got this complex research study that's been done. It's hard to tease out what it means. What's the take-home message and what can we do?
Making it relatable. So taking that academic research and making it feel like a practitioner can apply it.
Yeah. That's what I think is fun.
Yeah, that's important work because I just finished a master's program, and sometimes reading those academic studies can make you go a little batty. And as a practitioner trying to figure out how to take what they learned and then implement it within an organization can sometimes be a challenge.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Dan. Remember, everyone deserves a great leader. So keep working on being the best leader you can be. Until next time, I'll talk to you then.
This podcast is an original production of Global Talent Management at Herman Miller Group. It's hosted by me, Heather Esposito, and produced in music by Sean Beck.